بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. آداب و صلات. Discourse number 1, chapter 3, concerning humility, خشوع. One of the things which is necessary for the traveler to Allah, for the salik, in one's ibadat, especially in salat, which ranks at the top amongst them all, is humility. Now here, Imam just adds something after mentioning Salat. He says, Salat which ranks at the top amongst them all due to its comprehensive nature. He adds that. The reason why amongst all the Ibadat, Salat ranks, you know, the highest is because of its comprehensive nature. Now, what is the comprehensive nature of Salat? We covered this in chapter 1. So, if those who, you know, haven't listened to the previous lectures, they have to go back. Anyway, something which is necessary for the traveler, for one who wants to acquire that true proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, one of the stations, one of the ranks which is important to acquire is that of humility. And the Arabic is khushu. Now, this lecture, inshallah, in this chapter, it's all about humility. Its definition, how one acquires it, and that's quite important here. Then Imam continues that the reality of humility is defined as complete submission blended with, and I'll add in brackets, or, you know, that complete submission that results from, okay, now either blended with or that results from, in, you can choose either, they should mean the same here. In any case, it's that complete submission blended with love or fear. So let me just, on the outside, just give my own explanation here. And then once we go through Imam's words, I think it'll be absorbed more easily. What Imam is saying that by means of tafakkur, deliberation, in a specific manner, and as a result of that tafakkur and deliberation, it leads to that tawajjuh, which is a form of awareness. Now, one of the brothers emailed me and he wanted to know the difference between tawajjuh and muraqabah. Okay, muraqabah is one of the really important steps in spiritual wayfaring. It's a form of paying attention to one's actions, from action to action, moment to moment, but this paying attention to one's actions has to be done in a certain manner. Now, I have given two lectures on muraqabah, and you can look at those in the month of Ramadan 2012 lectures. I think lectures 5 and 6. In any case, here, muraqabah is a general concept. There are different ways one can pay attention to one's actions from moment to moment, the end result being acquiring that true proximity and becoming a mukhlas. That's the aim of muraqabah, becoming a mukhlas. But it's a general concept. Now, there are different tariqas, different paths you can acquire them. Allama Tabatabai has brought his own method. You can find it in Lubbul Lubab, and there are others. Tawajjuh is a device. Okay, tawajjuh, which results from tafakkur. This tafakkur and tawajjuh come hand in hand. These are devices in used for muraqabah. They're not, you know, independent steps in sayru suluk. Although tafakkur can be, but in any case, these two are devices of muraqabah. They assist, enhance one's muraqabah, and therefore assists one in that path to becoming more and more mukhlis, and eventually, inshallah, mukhlas. Anyway, here, with tafakkur, with tawajjuh, with respect to Allah's beauty, okay, with respect to Allah's majesty, so in relation to Allah's jamali and jalali, which is attributes of beauty and majesty, respectively, when you do tafakkur and acquire tawajjuh to these attributes of Allah, it will either lead to a certain kind of love and ecstasy, or it can lead to, if you deliberate over the attributes of Allah's beauty, it leads to a form of love. Now I'll come to these, I'll give examples later on. Or if you deliberate and acquire tawajjuh in relation to Allah's attributes of jalal, of majesty, there it'll lead to a form of fear. In any case, tafakkur in relation to the attributes will, depending on the attributes, will lead to you acquiring a form of love or fear. And that love or fear, either one of them, over time, eventually would lead you to become humble before Allah. Okay, now let me just give a very simple example, although it may not be the best of examples of here, is, for example, a man and woman, the man wants to marry. He goes and researches and wants to find out, you know, to find this woman, and then they find a woman, and he deliberates and acquires tawajjuh in relation to the attributes of this woman, the beauty and so on and so forth. And then after a while, after a lot of research, now there's a lot of love acquired. And you know, before, 1 week before the marriage, all the man is thinking of, or the other way around, doesn't matter, but all one of them is thinking about is about the other party, about the future, the to-be spouse. They're driving, they're thinking of the spouse-to-be. They're working at university, they're studying at university, at the workplace, and so on and so forth. They're eating, they keep on thinking of her. You see, well, how, why? Because of tafakkur, because of their awareness at tawajjuh, which has resulted. All they're doing is they're thinking of the woman's beauty. And then that helps in recalling that woman, wherever they are, eating, drinking, they can't sleep, they can't eat now, they're driving, they're studying at the workplace. Now this has to be acquired in relation to Allah. But in relation to Allah, it's much easier, because he's closer to us than our jugular vein. Now what that means, we have to come to that one day. Okay? In our fitrah, Allah resides there. Now I know these are heavy terms, but we'll come to them. But it's much easier to acquire this muraqabah in relation to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than other than Allah. Another example with the attributes of majesty is you want to choose the best university, for example. And then you look at the syllabuses of different universities, and they look very difficult. They have a lot of stipulations, rules, regulations, and then the dean of the university, the chancellors of the university are very strict people. You study about their lives, how they treat others, and so on and so forth. Then you have to have an interview with one of these, you know, deans of the department or whatever. Now, when you go there, after deliberating and researching on the university, about the syllabus, the course, the dean, and so on and so forth, now you acquire this fear. Because you want to get in. You want to be accepted by the dean. Now you're going to see the dean. You have a fear now that you're going to be rejected. This is important for you. That fear will lead to you becoming humble. In the same way where the love acquired by researching about the spouse-to-be, it reaches a stage, that love, that then you will be humble out of that love for the other party. So whatever she says, you say, of course, you'll do whatever she wants. Here too, when you speak with the dean, but out of fear, whatever the dean says, you accept. You become humble to the dean out of that fear that has been acquired as a result of tawajjuh and tafakkur. Now, I'm not sure if I was able to convey this point, but this is an important. The crux of this session will be about what I've just said. But you know, just marginal points surrounding it. Okay. So, Imam says that the reality of humility is defined as complete submission blended with, or that which results from, love or fear. And this is acquired by perceiving the power and strength and grandeur of Allah's beauty and majesty. You have to perceive the power of Allah, the strength of Allah, the grandeur of Allah's beauty. You have to perceive, understand, acknowledge Allah's majesty. This has to be done in order for that love or fear, depending on which aspects of Allah's attributes you're focusing on, that love and fear or fear will arise, and then either one of them, once it reaches a certain threshold, it would lead to you becoming humble before Allah. We need this for our ibadat, especially salat, Imam says. Now here in the definition, Imam says that complete submission, which is blended with love or fear. Why the variation? Why two? Why wasn't it only love or fear? Imam says the variation that resides in this very general definition arises because the Salik's inner disposition is not uniform. People deliberate differently. People see the cup half full, some see it half empty. Both are good. Okay, in that common psychological scenario which they give in the West to analyze people, do they see it half empty or half full? Those who see it half full, they're supposed to be good and they're optimistic, whereas the others are pessimistic. Well, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. They're both good. It's just that it's good to see the cup half full. It's also good to see it half empty. They're both good attributes, but people differ. Our inner dispositions, they're not all uniform. Some see it half full, some see it half empty. When it comes to Allah's attributes, depending on 1,001 different parameters from our background, what we've studied, you know, parents, this, that, and the other, all these different parameters, depending on there, some people are, they can more easily deliberate upon Allah's attributes of beauty, leading to that love. Some people can only focus on those attributes of majesty. That's also acceptable, leading to that fear. Some people can do both. That's ideal. Some people can do neither. That's not ideal. Okay. Now, and then Imam continues. Some hearts are love-orientated, and they manifest Allah's beauty. You know, for example, you know, they always emanating from them are attributes such as they're always hopeful, they're always happy, compassionate, loving, optimistic, and they manifest Allah's attributes of beauty. Now, according to and on a par with their inner nature, these people who are love orientated, according to and on a par with their inner nature, they're attracted to and have an affinity towards the beloved's beauty. That's, they're more on a tune, on a par with the attributes of Allah's beauty. And therefore, it's all love, it's all hope, it's all compassion, it's all forgiveness, it's all being optimistic, and so on and so forth. That's okay. That's, some people are like that. Okay, people are different. And these people, they can manifest Allah's beauty more easier. They can focus on Allah's beauty. They can deliberate on Allah's attributes of beauty more easier. And they have to keep on doing this until that love reaches such a threshold that now that love of Allah has entered their hearts to such an extent, now they become humble, like the man and woman example I gave at the beginning. Since such people, Imam continues, in their wayfaring, since such people perceive the manifestations of divine beauty or witness the divine beauty itself, they even see Allah in all things. And some people see things as manifestations of Allah's beauty. Some people see Allah in all things. Chapter 215, for example. فَأَيْنَمَا تُوَلُوا فَثَمَّ وَجْهُ اللَّهِ. They see the divine beauty. Some see the manifestations of Allah's beauty. These are different stages of spirituality here. So, since such people, in their wayfaring, perceive the manifestations of divine beauty, or witness the divine beauty itself, seeing Allah in all things, they've reached a level where all things are uttering, you know, I am beauty, I am beauty, anal jamal. It's like the tree with Prophet Musa, who said an al-haq, that was a certain spirituality level that Prophet Musa had, saw everything haq. Some people see everything uttering an al-jamal, I am beauty. Anyway, but since some people, they perceive either the manifestations or the divine essence of Allah, what happens is that the hidden grandeur that is hidden within the beauty's essence, okay, so there's a hidden grandeur, there's a hidden majestiness which is concealed within the beauty's essence. Now, either that beauty can be the essence of Allah's beauty or it hidden in the manifestations of beauty. It doesn't matter. It can either be the manifestation of beauty or absolute beauty itself. But there's a hidden majestiness. There's a hidden grandeur that's hidden in that beauty's essence. So when these people perceive the manifestations of divine beauty or that absolute beauty per se, chapter 215, what happens is that hidden grandeur, which is concealed in that absolute beauty or manifestation of that beauty, it knocks them out. It annihilates them. And this results in their entering a state of ecstasy or rapture. Now, I'll give one example, Quranic example soon. Then Imam continues, note that in every beauty, be it the manifestation of beauty or beauty itself, there's a hidden majesty. And in every majesty, be it a manifestation of that majesty or that the essence of majesty, there lies a hidden beauty. Doesn't matter how you're orientated, how you see the world, how you see the attributes of Allah, which attributes you focus on more, which attributes you're more on a par with. But in every beauty, in every jamal, there's a jalali aspect and dimension to it. And in every majesty, in every attribute of majesty, there's a jamali, there's a beauty aspect hidden in it. This fact, Imam continues, may be the subject matter of the following tradition by Amirul Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, where he said, immaculate is he whose mercy, he referring to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, immaculate is Allah whose mercy encompasses his friends whilst his punishment and wrath is at the same time severe. He punishes them, but there's beauty in that punishment. Okay, because his mercy encompasses, you know, his friends. But at the same time, he punishes too. Now this punishment doesn't have to always have a negative aspect to it, this punishment and wrath. The fact is that Allah may bring around punishment and wrath, but there's beauty in it. He brings around the limitation, but there's an opening within it. Actually, in one of the verses of the Quran, inna ma'al usri yusra. I just can't remember exactly which chapter it's in. But in this verse, it says, with every hardship, there's an opening, there's ease. It doesn't say after every hardship. Now, this is important here to understand this point. With every hardship, at the same time that the hardship is being externally realized, there's ease in this. So Allah may be punishing, but there's beauty at the same time. Allah may be exhibiting or disclosing his attributes of majesty, his jalali attributes, but there's jamal and beauty hidden there at the same time. So, immaculate is Allah whose mercy encompasses his friends, whilst his punishment and wrath is at the same time severe. Although here in the example I gave, it was in relation to the same person where that beauty and majesty can be exhibited or displayed at the same time. You can use the example for two different people at two different times. And then the tradition from Amirul Mu'mineen continues, or he, referring to Allah, whose punishment and wrath is severe in relation to his enemies, whilst his mercy is simultaneously all-embracing. Here, Allah loves, but there's Allah loves people, but there's a majestiness, a leadership, a conquering nature, a revenge dimension, an upper hand in that love. This is in relation to one person. If we look at one person, we may see that they're being loved by Allah, attributes of beauty, but at the same time, there's an upper hand. There's a Allah conquering that person. There's a majestiness of Allah which is ruling upon that person. Okay, I'll give two examples, inshallah, in a minute, both of these examples, so that things become clear. So, Imam continues, divine beauty may manifest Jalali attributes, such as knocking one out, and divine majesty may manifest Jamali attributes, such as increasing one's love for Allah. Okay, now here I want to give two examples, both in the same chapter of the Holy Quran, so that we understand this concept of wherever there's beauty from manifested from Allah, there's majestiness concealed in that beauty. And wherever there's majestiness manifested by Allah, there's beauty concealed within it. But they're manifested at the same time. It's just that one manifests externally, whilst the other, at the same time, it's manifesting non-externally, if you like, internally. But they're both manifesting at the same time. In every beauty, in every jamal, there is majestiness, jalali attributes. In every majesty, there is concealed within it attributes of beauty. Now, returning to the state of ecstasy and rapture after experiencing the divine beauty, that beauty. Now, here, if you recall, if we just go back two paragraphs, there we said that since such people perceive the manifestations of divine beauty or witness divine beauty itself, what happens is that the hidden grandeur, that majestiness, that is hidden within the beauty's essence, knocks them out, annihilates them. And this results in their entering a state of ecstasy or rapture. So Allah is manifesting externally to them. They see that divine beauty, but there's a majesty dimension concealed in that divine beauty, and that majesty dimension knocks them out. Because knocking people out, annihilating people, having the upper hand, conquering over people's hearts, these are attributes of majesty. They're not attributes of beauty. It's knocking people out here. So there's these people are recipient to divine beauty, and at the same time, because of that hidden majestiness within that divine beauty, they become knocked out. There's a majestiness in every attribute of beauty, in the same way that there's a beauty dimension in every attribute of majesty. So returning to that state of ecstasy and rapture, after experiencing the divine beauty, that beauty which leads to majestiness, knocking people out. A Quranic story that highlights this truth is the event with the women of the aristocracy in Egypt, when Yusuf alayhi salam entered the room. Chapter 12, verse 31. And when they saw him, when they saw Yusuf, a prophet, a messenger, an imam, a complete manifestation of Allah's attributes. But here, and all of Allah's attributes manifest in this figure called Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. But because of this worldly figure, at this age of his life, being male, this, that and the other, with all those things, that which manifested more in this prophet were his attributes of beauty. So the Quran reads, and when they saw him, when those women became a recipient to that divine beauty, they saw divine beauty, the women of the aristocracy. They were the recipient of Allah's beauty, of that divine beauty. Through Yusuf, though, they greatly admired him. This is divine beauty after all. And cut their hands. Now, I don't want to necessarily negate the external side of the story, but don't discard or be oblivious to the esoteric dimensions here. They cut their hands, esoterically meaning because they were a recipient to Allah's divine beauty, with the knife of recalling Allah. Okay, let's look at this esoterically now. The knife being recalling only Allah, because they only saw that beauty emanating from Yusuf, that divine beauty. And as a result of being absorbed in that divine beauty, they negated other than Allah. So they cut their hands and said, "Perfect is Allah. This beauty is not that of a man. This is none but a noble angel." Now here the word for angel is malak. In some of the recitations of the Quran, it's read malik. And if you read it as malik, they say this is nothing but a noble Allah, a noble God, that noble king, referring to Allah. But the popular version is malak. This is nothing but a noble angel. But they cut their hands, because they were absorbed in that divine love. But within every beauty, there's a hidden majestiness. And that came, and it led to the cutting of their hands. It led to them being knocked out. It led to their ecstasy. It led to their rapture, and so on and so forth. So that's an example for one example there. Now there's another story in the Holy Quran which highlights when attributes of majesty leads to beauty. This is the other side now of the formula. And this is also found in the story of Yusuf when his stay was extended in prison. You see, this story has been misinterpreted. And unfortunately, I couldn't find a book of a very good scholar who's written this book in Farsi. And I wanted to read it to you, although I wouldn't have mentioned his name, but I wanted to read you how he interpreted the story of the prison when Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam forgot about Allah, told the person who was about to be freed to tell the king to recall Yusuf, and because of forgetting Allah, Yusuf alayhi salam, Allah extended his stay in prison. It wasn't like that. Come on, you can't compromise the status of ismat, of infallibility of these people. Here, in this story, we see that there's an attribute of majestiness here. And that is Yusuf alayhi salam, his stay in prison has been extended by Allah. Because attributes of majesty is when Allah has a conquering, manifests with a conquering nature. He has majestiness, leadership, the upper hand, revenge, and so on and so forth. These are all attributes of majesty. Here, Allah now does something which is on a par with his majestiness, and that is extending the imprisonment of Yusuf. Okay? Now, the problem is when we say why the imprisonment was extended. We say because Yusuf alayhi salam, he forgot about Allah. But that's not the case. That's compromising the infallibility of Yusuf alayhi salam. Here, in this majesty, there's a concealed beauty. And the beauty is becoming nearer and nearer to Allah. To levels that are inconceivable to us. But staying more and more in the prison, that proximity, which is infinite, that proximity to Allah, Yusuf was going nearer and nearer, mi'raj after mi'raj. Now, this is an example of that hidden beauty that arises out of Allah's attributes of majesty. But inshallah, if I try and find that book, we can go into that story in more detail. But I just wanted to explain that tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam by giving these two examples. Hence, the grandeur and greatness of that divine beauty embraces the traveller, embraces the salik, and leads to his or her state of humility before the beauty of the beloved. So here we're still speaking in relation to those people whose hearts are love orientated. Here Allah says that Imam says that the grandeur and that greatness of that divine beauty, after tafakkur, after tawajjuh, embraces the salik, the traveller, of the spiritual traveler, and this leads to them being, you know, becoming humble, like in the man and woman example I gave, before the beauty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This state may initially lead to an inner chaos within the person, and after reposing, the preceding state of bedlam and insecurity will be converted to one of affinity and composure, leading to a state of inner tranquility. This was the state of Allah's friend. So, in the beginning, when one is enamored and totally embraced by Allah's divine beauty, it may lead to an inner chaos, bedlam. One may be a bit act in a haphazard way now and again, but once this period dies down and one reposes, and this bedlam becomes converted to a state of composure, one, and this requires practice, this one becomes or enters a new state of spirituality, and that's called one of inner tranquility, itminan. The next chapter will be touching upon this, so I won't go into that into detail. And then Imam says this was the state of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. Now, which story he's referring to? It can either be the story of Ibrahim and the four birds, where the concept of tranquility, itminan, لِيَتْمَعِنَّ قَلْبِي is mentioned there, or it can be in reference to the story where Ibrahim alayhi salam sees the moon and says, this is my Rab, and then the stars, and then the sun, and then he keeps on refuting each of them as the Rab, as the Lord. Although what this means, there are inner esoteric dimensions to them. I think I've spoken about this before at Yasin. Now, they may have it recorded, I'm not sure, but this was around 2 years ago, about that story. Anyway, we'll speak more about this inner tranquility status, inshallah, in the next chapter. Then Imam continues and says, some hearts are fear-orientated. So up to now, we've spoken about those hearts that are love-orientated, but some people are more on a par with the attributes of Allah's majestiness. And these people manifest Allah's majesty. They always perceive of Allah's sovereignty, Allah's majesty. You know, like such as, you know, they fear hell, they fear the fire, they fear being conquered, they fear being dishonored, they fear being deviated, they fear being deceived by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they fear being taken revenge upon. These are the attributes that they, you know, keep on focusing upon. And this was the state of Yahya, Prophet Yahya, John, alayhi salam. Now here, and there's a tradition from Imam Sadiq, it's not mentioned in the book, but I do recall this tradition, where someone asked Imam Sadiq that, you know, Prophet Yahya kept on crying and was always in a state of sorrow, because he was always deliberating over the attributes of Allah's majestiness. You know, fear of this, fear of that, and so on and so forth. And then they said to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that Prophet Isa, though, Prophet Jesus alayhi salam, he was always in a state of happiness and joy, because he was love orientated. I mean, he was both, but that which predominated was the love orientation of Prophet Isa. Then the clever companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he asked a question which is very useful for me and you today. Which one is more important? Which one is more significant? And then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, the way of Isa is better. To be occupied with the attributes of beauty. They're both okay. They're both acceptable. But it's better, the Isawi way is better. Then Imam summarizes that khushu, this humility, is sometimes blended with love and sometimes with fear, but with every love there's an element of fear, and with every fear there's an element of love. Okay, so that you should, inshallah, that should be clear up to now. So we've given the definition, and how we have to acquire it has also been explained by Imam. Next, Imam speaks about the definition, the concept of khushu. He wants to open it up. He wants to explore this concept of humility. And he does that by going through one or two verses of the Quran. He says the level of khushu is proportional to the degree of perception in relation to Allah's attributes, in relation to Allah's grandeur, beauty and majesty. Depending on how properly you deliberate and perceive Allah's grandeur, beauty and majesty, okay, the higher that is, the higher the depth, the higher the intensity of your deliberating and perception of Allah's grandeur, beauty and majesty, the higher your khushu, your humility will be. Imam writes, since the likes of us are suppressed in receiving the light of unveiling, that shuhud, mushahide, we are but to endeavor in acquiring khushu by means of knowledge and faith. He says, we, as people like me and you, you know, we may never unveil the metaphysical truths of things. However, if you remember the four stages that we covered last week, the first two was knowledge and faith. He says, through these two, though, we can acquire a degree of khushu. But khushu out of witnessing the metaphysical truths, that's far, and you know, that's far away from people like me and you, Imam writes. Now, steps one and two of the four stages that were covered, in lesson three, which was a preceding chapter last week. So for those who haven't listened, they can go back. Then Imam starts his analysis on the concept. He wants to explore this concept of khushu through the first two steps, knowledge and faith. In chapter 23, verse 1 and 2, certainly the believers have attained to salvation. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. And then explains who these mu'minun, who these believers are. الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ. Those who in their salats, they are humble. Now this preposition, fi, for those who have listened to my other lectures, they would have already understand why I'm emphasizing this preposition, fi. The irfan of the Quran are hidden in these prepositions and particles. Those who have entered the inner side of salat, الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ, they will be of the خَاشِعُونَ. Because they've, in addition to the superficial aspect of salat, they've gone deeper. They've gone deeper into the salat. As a result of going deeper, now they've become one of the خَاشِعُونَ, those who are humble. So the verse says, the believers have attained salvation, and they are those who are humble in their salat. Now Imam continues his analysis. He says, khushu in salat, this humility in salat, is assigned within the jurisdiction and boundaries of faith. Those who are not submissive and who are not humble, therefore, in salat, are outside the framework of iman. They're outside the framework of faith. Because the verse says, the believers, okay, the mu'minun, they have attained salvation. Okay, so they are those, these are people who have entered salat as it should be entered, and they are humble in salat. The believers are humble in salat. If me and you are not humble in salat, we're outside the framework of true faith. Hence, Imam continues, our khushu-less salats are side effects of either being deficient in faith or the fact that faith is non-existent. Belief and knowledge are not the same as faith, Imam says. The knowledge of Allah, the knowledge of Allah's names, the knowledge of Allah's attributes, and all knowledge, okay, in religion, that we acquire within ourselves is other than faith. Just because you have knowledge of Allah, His names, attributes, just because you have knowledge of a religion, knowledge of Tawheed, knowledge of Nubuwwah, knowledge of Ma'ad, just because you know everything there is to know about Imamology and so on and so forth, that doesn't mean you have faith in them. These are two different things. One is a step to the other. But knowledge alone doesn't mean you have faith in them. You may have all their knowledge, but still in your salat, there's no humility. You're still not within the framework of the believers yet. Then Imam enters a small discussion on Iblis. Now the likes of Ibn Arabi have really expounded on this theme of Iblis. Faiz Kashani also, he has interesting theories into who Iblis or what Iblis is. And Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Hafizahullah has collected all these and listed 7 different understandings of Iblis. All of them are acceptable and there's no problem with them. And he lists them in one of his works. But I don't want to get too drowned in that here right now. But inshallah we'll come to it one day. Imam then writes, he says, Shaitan has knowledge in relation to our origins. He has knowledge in relation to Inna Lillah, that we're all Allah's. And Shaitan has knowledge in relation to resurrection, that wa inna ilayhi raji'un. He believes in, you know, he has belief, he has knowledge in relation to Allah, Tawheed, and Ma'ad, resurrection. But Allah still calls him a kafir. Okay? Now, his testimony and confession or profession to Allah's creatorship is seen in chapter 7, verse 12. خَلَقْتَنِي مِنْ نَارِ وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِنْ تِينِ. Iblis is saying this. He's saying, you created me from fire, but you created him, in relation to Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, from clay. But he believes, in any case, he does believe in Allah's creatorship. And Iblis's belief in resurrection is seen in chapter 7, verse 14, when he says to Allah, أَنْذِرْنِي إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ. Grant me respite until the day they are resurrected. He believes in resurrection, therefore. He has knowledge in relation to the books, the divine books. He has knowledge in relation to the messengers, in relation to the angels. But still Allah calls him a kafir. Allah throws him out of the ranks of the believers, because he used to be a believer. So knowledge minus faith, you know, it's of no use to us. Okay, now note, when Iblis was a believer, then what happens is he loses in a certain test that was given. Although I don't want to go into the story now, but as a result of what happened, he then was exited amongst the ranks of the believers. But he still believed in Allah up to today. He still believes in Allah. He still believes in resurrection. But he's no longer a believer. He's not one of the mu'minun anymore. Now here, he's called a kafir. Now how can he be a kafir if he still believes in Allah up to, you know, now? He still believes in resurrection. He still believes in prophethood. So why is he a kafir? When Allah calls him a kafir, although kafir here has 2 or 3 meanings, the meaning which is the most correct is kafir means one who hides something. He was hiding something. In that test, it was disclosed. Now, in which realm of existence this test occurred, I've spoken about it in the series on apparitions. In any case, when Allah calls him a kafir, it's not the canonical Sharia kafir which is meant, because he still believes in Allah. He still has knowledge of Allah. He has belief in relation to Allah. Okay, he's not one of the mu'minun anymore, but he still has that knowledge in relation to Allah. He has that belief that Allah exists, resurrection exists. He still has these. So it can't be the canonical kafir which is referred to. Here, we can therefore also be kafir, not the Sharia kafir. But if we never enter the realm of the mu'minun, we're also a kafir. But this is not a Sharia. This is like a tariqa kafir. One who is a kafir in tariqa. It's a spiritual manifestation of being a kafir. Not a fiqhi Sharia kafir. Because, for example, we believe in Allah. We believe in, you know, the usuluddin and so on and so forth. Now, we see this a lot in the traditions. You see, terms like kafir, munafiq, Islam, iman, these have degrees to it. For example, in one tradition, it says, one who groans of the food that his wife puts on the table, or one who tells the woman what food to cook. Okay, these people in the traditions are called, they're part of the munafiqeen. They're amongst the munafiqeen. You know, hypocrites. But these people have faith. They have faith in Tawheed. They have belief in Tawheed. They have knowledge of Nubuwa. They have knowledge of Ma'ad. How come just because of not, you know, being satisfied with the food or groaning about the food, how come all of a sudden such people, do they lose all that doctrinal belief that they have acquired? Of course not. This is a different degree of being a munafiq now. This is in the spiritual realm, in the tariqa realm. There are many stages of being a munafiq. There's many stages of being a kafir. There's not only one definition. There are degrees to this. Now, we may speak about this later on. The people of knowledge are not necessarily the people of iman. Okay, so the ahlul ilm, the people of knowledge, just because they have a lot of knowledge, they're not necessarily the ahlul iman. We have to, you know, differentiate between them. Hence, after passing the path of knowledge, one must incorporate oneself within the path of iman and thus endeavor to incorporate Allah's beauty, majesty and grandeur into one's heart, thus becoming humble before him. Then we enter the stage of being a believer. Otherwise, mere knowledge, Imam writes, does not bring khushu with itself. One just need look at oneself to grasp the reality behind this truth. Just because you have just this knowledge, it doesn't bring khushu. Khushu requires a lot of work, contemplation, tawajjuh, in relation to Allah's grandeur, majesty, beauty, and so on and so forth, to such an extent that it enters the heart. Once it enters the heart, now you've entered the realm of iman. Then Imam brings another verse of the Quran, chapter 57, verse 16. Is it not time yet for those who have faith? لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. So isn't it time for those who have faith that their hearts should be humbled for Allah's remembrance and to the truth that has come down to them? Here the question is, I thought the mu'mineen had humility by definition. So how come the mu'mineen in this verse are addressed to acquire humility? Because up to now we've said that to be one of the mu'mineen, you have to be humble. That's one of the attributes of being one of the mu'mineen. Those who in their salat, fi salatim, they're one of the khashi'een. I thought that therefore whoever's really one of the mu'mineen, lilladhina amanu, those who have faith, if you're one of that, it means you have humility already. So the first question in relation to chapter 57, verse 16, is that, well, why are the mu'mineen addressed? They already have humility. So why should they be told to acquire humility? Because they already have it. Imam gives two answers here. He says that this iman, this faith mentioned in the verse, in that لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, may be the superficial degree of iman, which is tantamount just to belief in that which was brought by the Prophet. Otherwise, true iman bears a degree of humility with it from the start. Okay, so Imam is saying as if there's a very superficial definition of humility, that mere acceptance of whatever the Prophet has brought, you accept. Okay, that may also be defined as humility at a very superficial degree. And maybe the verse is in reference to this superficial degree of humility. Okay, that's one answer which Imam gives. Sorry about that. No, I just realized I've just made a mistake. He says that the iman mentioned in this verse, لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, may be a very superficial degree of iman. Okay, so in iman, we previously said that to be one of the mu'mineen, you have to possess a degree of humility. The verse says to the mu'mineen, that you, it's time now for you to acquire humility. So the question is that I thought that the mu'mineen already had, those people of faith already had humility. Why should they be told to acquire humility when they already have it? Imam, his first justification of this verse is that there are many definitions of iman, And the definition of iman in this verse, لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, that those people who have faith should acquire humility, those people of faith, the faith here is the superficial degree of faith. And that is to accept that which has been brought by the Holy Prophet. It hasn't entered one's heart. The mere acceptance of it is a very superficial degree of iman, as if it's like this that Imam wants to put forward here. Or another understanding that Imam wants to put forward, he says that the khushu in this verse is a more perfect variation of humility. Okay, so yes, you're right that the definition of being a believer, it recognizes the fact that you have a degree of humility. But now in this verse, it's saying to these mu'mineen who have humility, there's a higher degree of humility. Isn't it time for you to acquire that stage of humility? Okay, so here in the first explanation, he was saying there are different forms of iman, and it's a superficial one intended. Here, in relation to the term khushu mentioned here, it's a more developed and perfected variation of khushu, which the believers who have the first or second degree of khushu now are told to acquire higher forms of khushu. And then Imam says, we see this also sometimes in other terms, like alim, one who has knowledge, is sometimes used in the Quran in reference to one has incorporated faith within oneself. Okay, and this is possible. It's not mere knowledge now. His understanding of knowledge has gone further than just merely having knowledge, but he's incorporated that knowledge within one's heart. Such a person, sometimes we can see in the Holy Quran, we see the word alim, one who has knowledge, being used in reference to them. And in chapter 35, verse 28, إِنَّمَا يَخْشَ اللَّهُ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ الْعُلَمَاءِ, only those of Allah's servants having knowledge fear him. Okay, this ulama, those Allah's servants having knowledge, ulama is used in the term, the plural of alim. Here, these people, they've incorporated humility within themselves, and therefore they have faith, and as a result of that humility which they've acquired, why was it acquired? Because that knowledge which they learned, they incorporated within their hearts, and it led to a degree of fear. And the verse says, only those of Allah's servants having knowledge, but this knowledge is of high degree and which has been incorporated over time within one's heart, fear Allah. Okay, and then these people become humble. They're mu'mineen. But the Arabic, the word used is ulama. This verse can be interpreted in other ways. Some people regard the term ulama, not the plural of alim, which Imam is presupposing here, and it is a morphological accuracy to say that ulama, it can be the plural of alim, but I think it's more accurate that ulama, some people say, is the plural of alim, and here it's different now. Being alim is different to being an alim. But anyway, Imam wanted to explain that verse in different ways. Another verse, although Imam hasn't brought this verse, where alim is regarded as those who have, you know, it's more than just mere knowledge. They've acquired this certain degree of faith, and they've gone beyond the physical and have entered the metaphysical, is a verse where it says, تِلْكَ الْأَمْثَالُ نَدْرِبُهَا لِلنَّاسِ وَمَا يَعْقِلُهَا إِلَّا الْعَالِمُونَ. Now, Imam hasn't brought this, I've just added it. In relation to heaven and hell, the sirat and these things, the Quran says, these are just examples that we've given, and only the alimun will understand them. Here, the alimun isn't those who have mere knowledge, but it's they have a degree of faith also, but they're called alim here. And this supports Imam's idea of alim having degrees to it also. In any case, there are degrees to ilm, knowledge, there are degrees to Islam, there are degrees to iman, there are degrees to kufr, there are degrees to being a munafiq, there's degrees to khushu, and so on and so forth. If you want to have a good understanding of these degrees of Islam and Iman, of being a munafiq and being a kafir and so on and so forth, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum's treatise on Sayru Suluk, on spiritual wayfaring, which has been translated into English, gives it in the best possible way. I've gone through it in, I think it was in the December 2010 at IEC in Houston. I did go through the different stages here. Also, Allama Tabatabai's Lobbul Lobab, written by one of his students, Muhammad Hussein Husseini Tehrani. And also in Al-Mizan, in Volume 1, under the verse of Chapter 2, verse, I think, 128 or 130. I can't recall exactly now. But there, it's a story about Ibrahim and him passing the test and becoming an imam. There, also, Allama Tabatabai, in a very, very good way, he goes through the stages of Islam and Iman. Certainly worth reading it. And we may go through it if you know this book dictates it once in the future. In general, Imam continues, it's necessary for the traveller to the hereafter. Now, being a traveller to the hereafter doesn't mean only when you die a physical death. We can transcend the realms of the hereafter right now in this world. It's necessary for the traveller to the hereafter, especially via the Mi'raji Salat, as Salatu Mi'rajul Mu'min. It's necessary for the traveller, the spiritual traveller, to submit one's heart with the light of knowledge and faith, and to accommodate and strengthen this divine gift and merciful gleam within one's heart to that extent which is feasible. Trying to preserve this state during the whole of Salat, and in all the Ibadat in general. And then Imam writes, this state of accommodation and establishment of humility in the beginning, you know, when beginning it's difficult to preserve it throughout the whole of Salat. In the beginning it's rather difficult for the likes of us. But with practice and disciplining of the heart, it becomes very feasible. And in this book it teaches us how we can acquire that, inshallah, later. Imam continues, my dear, acquiring perfection and the provisions for the hereafter requires desire and gravity, seriousness. However, proximity and the station of proximity in the presence of the Lord of Might are not to be attained through weakness, fatigue, and negligence. One must rise with firmness in order to get to one's goal. I mean, these last two paragraphs, you can read for yourselves, and I think you'll understand it. I couldn't find anything very significant to add, really. So I'm just going through the text here, and I'm just paraphrasing it. Then Imam here wants us to compare the two realms of the physical and the metaphysical, telling us that since these two are incomparable, both in relation to happiness and wretchedness, and that this happiness is to be acquired through obeying Allah, and then the best means for this obedience, for undertaking the aforementioned, this happiness and salvation, is that of Salat, okay, due to its comprehensive nature. And khushu is essential for Salat. So after comparing the different realms, you know, of the physical and metaphysical, saying that happiness in the metaphysical world is different, much better than happiness in this world. In the same way, wretchedness in the hereafter is much more perfect and much worse in wretchedness than wretchedness here. It's much more limited here. He says, therefore, this has to be acquired. We want to acquire this happiness. So he goes through the differences and says, in order to acquire it, we have to, the best means is to obey Allah in order to acquire that happiness and salvation. And the best way to obey Allah is through that Salat. It's the best way because it's due to that comprehensive nature of Salat, which was covered before in Lesson 2, in the previous chapter. And then Imam says, therefore, that's why it's important. And because khushu is essential for Salat, and khushu therefore becomes essential to acquire that happiness. Now here Imam wants us to compare the differences of perfection and deficiency in this realm, the physical realm, and the metaphysical realm. You see, there is pain in this realm, in the physical realm, but the pain in the hereafter is much more, because pain in this world is limited. This world is a world of limitation, of potentiality. If you burn, you keep on burning me, okay, or injuring my, let's say, arm, after a while I'll feel no pain. After all, the worst that will happen is my arm becomes amputated. Again, that's the end of pain. But in the hereafter, pain never ends. I mean, it does end, but I'm saying potentially it can keep on continuing. The degree of pain is a lot. Everyone to their own, depending on one's actions. But it's not like, it doesn't have the limitations that pain has in this realm. It's much worse. It's much less limited. But happiness in that realm is much more also than happiness in this realm. The joys of the hereafter are much more. It's more perfect. The difference of happiness and pain between the different realms is a difference of perfection and deficiency. They both have happiness, but the happiness in this realm is deficient compared to the happiness of that realm. That's why it says, whatever we eat, we never become satiated. But in this world, we do become satiated. We never go to the lavatory. The concept of a lavatory is non-existent in the hereafter. But due to limitations of this material realm, we have to go to the lavatory. We become satiated after drinking 2 glasses of, you know, water or whatever, 1 plate of food, and so on and so forth. But there we can keep on eating and eating. The traditions keep on speaking about it. Now, these are, you know, recreational joys, but, you know, when you compare eating and drinking, for example, it's of a much more perfect form and manifestation in the hereafter than it is here. And in other things too, one, the sexual appetite, it differs, and it goes into graphic detail some traditions, but I don't think this is the place to go. The joys of the hereafter, though, is much more than the joys of this material physical realm. The result, and Imam continued, the results and fruits of such an action are to be experienced in this world, and they are incomparable to any material joy one can think of. Now, they were just recreational enjoyments I was mentioning. The joy, the heavenly pleasures are infinite. You know, the degree being in proximity with Allah, that unity with Allah, speaking with Allah, and so on. So these are joys that are much more important than just a few huris and ghilman and palaces and food and this. And that's a recreational, they say, that's a recreational heaven, that's a minimal heaven. There are joys which are much more higher. But in any case, all these joys, these heavenly joys and enjoyments and pleasures, they can be acquired in this realm. One can be in heaven whilst living in this world. And that's the explanation of some traditions which says Prophet X or Y is in the fourth dimension of heaven. They're still here. They're in this world. They may be in occultation too, but they're in heaven. It's a state of their spirituality that these traditions are referring to. This joy has been conveyed in the states of those who supplicate in true proximity with the Lord. These states which express these heavenly pleasures of unity with Allah, speaking with Allah, that closeness with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these can be seen in the du'as of the Ahlul Bayt. And then finally, Imam writes, after acknowledging Allah's beauty, majesty, this is like a summary that Imam is giving. He says, after acknowledging Allah's beauty, majesty and grandeur, either via proof or words of the prophets, you know, in the traditions and so on and so forth, or via proof, for example, you did it through either philosophical proof and so on and so forth, or just through the words of the prophets, after acknowledging, though, Allah's beauty, majesty and grandeur, one's heart must recall and incorporate this. Gradually, step by step, by means of tadhakkur, by means of recalling this, and tawajjuh, that form of awareness, via tafakkur, and via persistence, see, 3 elements are used here, tadhakkur, tawajjuh, and persistence. Khushu will find its way to the heart for the desired result to be acquired. And eventually he tells us how this has to be acquired. He'll go into more detail. And then Imam writes, in no state and under no circumstances should the salik be content with the station or rank one is at. After all, whatever station which we may attain to is neither worth a cent in the bazaar of the people of knowledge, nor worth a mustard seed in the marketplace of the people of Irfan, Gnosis. That seed of mustard is much less worthy even than a cent, because here it's in the bazaar of the people of Irfan. That's why the expression the seed of mustard is used. It's much more non-worthier, it's much more less befitting than a scent even. So with the scent, he uses the bazaar of the people of knowledge. With the mustard seed, he uses the bazaar of the people of Irfan. MashaAllah. Anyway, he says, after, at the end, the salik must recall one's deficiencies and faults at all times and in all states. Maybe the door to salvation will open up to one via this path. Walhamdulillah. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala tahirin.